We're glad that you came out. I've been saying night service so long. I still want to say night service. It's hard for me to say night when the sun's halfway up the sky. But to this afternoon service, we appreciate your coming. Appreciate those who are visiting with us. Have some visitors with us, friends from Queens. And we're glad that they're here tonight. I said this morning and have announced before that we're going to talk about the history of the institutional controversy. We'll have various passages of scripture that we'll be discussing. We'll have a great deal of historical material that we'll be talking about. I don't claim to be a historian, but I can read history. And I am the place now where I've lived part of it, part of history. I read a thing here the other day. This child had a book, and his mother looked at it, and she said, 1955 is in the history book? Yeah, 1955 is in the history book. And I have lived some of this history that we're going to be talking about tonight. But let's go back to the very beginning to start with the church as God planned it to begin with. Going back to Acts chapter 14 and to verse 23. Acts 14, 23. And when they had ordained them elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believed. This is talking about when Paul and his companions went back through the area where they had previously established local churches. And they had, as they went back, they ordained elders in every church. Originally, local churches, all local churches, were independent, autonomous units. That is, they were self-governing, they were self-contained. They had no organization other than the local church under its elders that suggests here. In the Philippian letter, he speaks of the bishops or elders and the deacons and the saints. So originally, that's the only organization that God has for the church. But there have been a number of efforts through the years to try to activate the church universal. And by that I mean to be able to bring more Christians together than just what may compose a local church. To bring them together in some sort of organized capacity in order to do certain works that they believe the church needs to do. And so that at different levels and at different times in history, there have been those efforts to set up institutions or organized entities composed of churches and individual Christians that are set up to do the work that churches were told to do in the New Testament, and thus to activate the church on a higher scale and organize it on a higher scale than that of just a simple local congregation. And those efforts have been pretty well described under one heading, and that is institutionalism. That is, setting up institutions separate from and larger than local churches, through which local churches and individual Christians may do the work that God's assigned the church to do. But as I said originally, the only organization the church had was the local autonomous self-governing units called local churches. And the as we've read in Acts 14:23, they ordained elders in each one. Not elders over a number of churches, not elders over half the brotherhood, over all the brotherhood for that matter, but simply in each local group. And in Acts chapter 20 and verse 17, when Paul was on his way back to Jerusalem and he wanted to talk to the elders of the church down at Ephesus, it says that, and from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and call for the elders, plural, of the church, singular. Now, the church there that he's talking about is the elders of the local church at Ephesus. And it was a plurality of them. And that was basically the organization that God gave a local church under a plurality of elders. And then, as we noticed from Philippians, 1:1, serve the deacons and made up of bishops and deacons and the saints in Philippians 1 and verse 1. Then in 1 Peter chapter 5, and the first four verses, the Apostle Peter writes to elders and reminds them that he himself is a fellow elder. In this case, the Apostle Peter wore two or three hats. He was an apostle, he was an elder, and he's also a preacher of righteousness. But in writing to the elders, among those that were dispersed abroad that he addressed the letter to, he says, the elders which are among you I exhort, who have also an elder. So he's admonishing them as an apostle, all right enough, but also he reminds them that he's also an elder. It's not that he's elder over the other elders, but as an apostle, he was admonishing and teaching them and giving them the authority by which they were to act. The apostles had that authority. They had revealed to them God's plan in the gospel, and God's plan for the church had been revealed to them by inspiration or by revelation, and then they in turn spoke it and wrote it by inspiration. So he says, I exhort you, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, that qualified him, of course, to be an apostle, and also a partaker of that glory that shall be revealed. Now, this is what he tells the elders. Feed, the King James Version says, the American Standard says tend, and some of the others, like King James and others, say shepherd the flock of God which is among you. Shepherd, they would act as a shepherd, or, and that's the same word we'll get pastor from. They were actually shepherds or pastors, are tenders or feeders of the flock of God. The flock of God being the church. And he tells which flock, which is among you. They were not to feed or to tend or to superintend or to shepherd the flock way off somewhere. They were not to shepherd a flock that was much bigger than the local church of which they were members. He says, you tend the flock, or you feed the flock which is among you. Not by constraint, but willingly. Not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither has been lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, you receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. So he limits the, for lack of a better expression, the jurisdiction of these elders to the flock that was among them, that local church of which they were a part, that was among them, and not to, they were not to oversee any other church or any other congregation or local church other than the one that was among them. It was independent, autonomous in nature, self-governing in nature. And he didn't tell them to set up some sort of entity above that level where that they could have oversight of that entity and then maybe composed of other churches and individuals. They couldn't do that. It was limited to the flock that was among them. And he tells Titus to, in Titus 1 and verse 5, that he was ordained elders in every city, as I've appointed thee. But all of these are spoken of as independent units. When you read, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and 2 Corinthians chapter 1, unto the church of God which is at Corinth. That unit at Corinth. And the church at Ephesus and the church at Laodicea and the church at other places spoken of as independent units in the scriptures. There was no activation at all of the church on any level when I talk about the church here, I'm talking about the church in the universal sense. There's no activation of the church on any level into an organization except at the local level, except the local congregation. It was an active, functioning unit within itself. And there are no active, functioning units that were organized higher than or even smaller than the local church. But periodically, since the apostles died, and that's how it was in the days of the apostles. After the apostles died, there have been periodically efforts made to activate the universal church. Again, let me explain again what I mean by activate the universal church. That is to form some sort of project, some sort of organization that oversees work of Christians larger than the local church, made up of, and these units are often made up of churches contributing to them, as well as individuals contributing to them, and they're overseeing that work. But there have been efforts to do that. And it started out just shortly after the apostles were dead and after they'd gone on, and the efforts to activate the church at a higher level began. And we're going to notice that first and to show that in order to get some idea of why the institutional controversy of which we are familiar with in the last 50 to 100 years that makes it such a made it such a controversy and made it such a big deal. But anyway, sometimes they bring in the entire program of churches under a central organization. Sometimes they bring certain aspects of churches under a central organization. Either a separate organization or a central congregation that oversees the work of a number of congregations. So our purpose in this lesson is to show the historical developments leading to the centralization of the church above the local level into some sorts of institutions different from that of a local church. And it leads to this this centralization in three different periods of history that will help us to understand even our present situation. The first thing I want to notice is the development, as I've suggested, the development near the first century and following. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and in verse 3, Paul wrote to the church at Thessalonica and said, "Let no man deceive you by any means." There were some at Thessalonica that were a little bit confused about the second coming of the Lord as to when he would actually come. And he's writing them to talk about that, but he says this as he does. He said, "Let no man deceive you by any means, that day," and he's talking about the day of the coming of the Lord, "shall not come except there be a falling away first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work." Other translations say the mystery of lawlessness doth already work. "Only he who now letteth or hinders will hinder until he be taken out of the way." Now he says this coming of the Lord is not going to come until there's a falling away first and the man of sin is revealed. Most of us understand that, and it's understood pretty much even among Protestants in general, that he's having reference to the falling away of the church that resulted in the Catholicism sometime later, and the man of sin being revealed, being even the Pope himself. That may or may not be so, but it seems to fit all right enough. But the point I want to make here is that even before Paul died, and while he's writing to those of Thessalonica, he realized there was going to come a falling away. There was going to come an apostasy from the Lord's way and the Lord's church. Now, as that apostasy developed, it really developed by trying to organize, here we go again, tried to organize the church in a capacity larger than and other than the local church. In a book that I have on my bookshelf is a book that I had in Survey of Civilization. Any of you have ever been to had freshman history is usually called Survey of Civilization. And we had that at Free Hartman College in the year after the flood. It seems to be that long ago sometimes. But we actually in 1954, we had this book. It's called Civilization Past and Present, third edition, page 230. There's been several editions since that. But there's a section in that on the development of the church and development of church offices. Now remember, this is a secular historian, but it pretty well lays out what took place immediately after the apostles had gone off the scene and in the second century and then following that. I want to read just a little bit from that. At first, there was little or no distinction. Now, this is, now you remember, this is a secular historian. He's not a religious person, per se. And some of the terms he used, I would not use, like laity and clergy. But still keep that in mind. But still, what he says is interesting. At first, there was little or no distinction between laity and clergy. In other words, there's not that distinction that they have now, laity and clergy. Soon, a number of famous teachers appeared who traveled about this in a far-flung Christian communities. And he's talking about Paul and others who traveled in those communities, to which they then preached and gave advice when was needed. At first, the officials were called elders, presbyters. They were also referred to as bishops, overseers. Now, he's right now at the end of the first century and talking about what happened then. By the second century, the office became distinct. The bishop now had the right to enforce obedience from his presbyters and from other subordinates such as stewards and recorders. So a bishop became one of the elders who, as I've said, sometimes got too big for his britches. He began to oversee the other elders within the congregation. But that's not the end of it. New churches organized in the country adjacent to the mother church, which was usually located in a city, were administered by presbyters responsible to the bishop. Here you've got your organization, now larger than the local church. You've got a bishop overseeing the presbyters or the elders in churches out in the rural section who were subject to the bishop in town who was over the mother church. Well, you've got an organization now. You've got institutionalism starting. You've got an institution larger than the local church binding people together in an organization bigger than and other than the local church. The office of bishop was the most important in the church. The bishop had charge of all the church property in the diocese and was the official interpreter of Christian dogma. You see, it beginning to go from the simple New Testament pattern after they organized at this higher level. Then the bishop took on more authority, and before long he became the interpreter of doctrine and not what the scripture said. The bishop of the most important city in each province, made up of a number of dioceses, enjoyed more prestige than his fellows and became known as archbishop or metropolitan. The provinces were grouped into another administrative division called the patriarch. The title of patriarch was applied to the bishop of such great cities as Rome and Alexandria. In a city like Constantinople, for example, a man could be a bishop, an archbishop, and a patriarch all at the same time. In the evolution of an organized hierarchy, the church was indebted to the Roman government models. In building their organizations, the Christian officials took over the administrative divisions of the Roman Empire and barred much from this law. The title of bishop, for example, came from an important office of the Roman municipality. Now, what all that's saying is this. They began to organize higher than the local church. They began to pool their work into an organization higher than and other than the local church. And then the officials in this higher organization began to exercise power and control over those who were under them. Institutionalism has now taken hold. And it led, finally, to the papacy. And around 600, these patriarchs he talked about within the various, about five of them in the various principal cities, finally one of them decided that he was going to be the chief one. And he declared himself to be universal bishop of the church. And that happened to be the Bishop of Rome. And that resulted in Catholicism as we know it. In the year 588 A.D., this is from church history for busy people, but a man by the name of Cleveland. In the year 588 A.D., the page archive Constantinople, or the Archbishop of Constantinople, John the Father, as soon take the title of Universal Bishop of the Church. Gregory the Great, at that time, was the Patriarch of Rome, and he is considered by Roman Catholics as one of the greatest and the most productive and the best popes that has been canonized to be a saint. Gregory the Great wrote to John the Faster as follows. You remember, my brother, the fees and the accord which the church enjoyed, the freedom and the accord which the church enjoyed when you are raised to your sacerdotal dignity. I do not therefore understand how you have dared to follow the inspiration of pride and have attempted to assume a title which may give offense to the brethren. That is the title of universal bishop. That's still a part of the title of the Pope now. One of them says this, once it left the local congregation, being independent, as long as it was left at that level, this couldn't have happened. But after you begin to activate the church on a higher level, then it's no stopping place. It goes to the next place, the next level, the next level, and finally it went to Rome. Well, there's another time in which we see it develop in another area. We know what the result of that was. The result of that was Catholicism. But it started with institutionalism. Now, we want to notice the developments during what we've come to call the Restoration Movement. And by the Restoration Movement, we mean the movement in the United States where certain men began to call men back to the Bible. Many of them were denominational preachers at the time, began to call men back to the Bible. Let's go back to the Bible for it all. Men like Martin W. Stone and Raccoon John Smith, Alexander and Thomas Campbell, and others. They began to see that denominationalism was not right, and that all the division that it represented was not right. And so rather than trying to do as the reformers had done in the 1500s, Luther and others, which only resulted in more denominations, they decided to go back to all of it and go back and restore New Testament Christianity just as it was depicted in the scriptures in the New Testament. And for a good while, they were pretty successful in doing this and were successful. And whether we recognize it or not, we today owe them a great deal for having done that, and thus we today in Churches of Christ that are still independent local congregations, we still owe a great deal of their calling folks back to the Bible. But that went along for a while, but they became an element within the churches that felt like that they couldn't get the gospel preached to the world, and they couldn't get the church work done throughout the world unless they had some organization or some organized capacity above the local level, above the local church. And they began then to experiment with certain things and certain organizations of the local church, enlarging the local church, in order to do the work of preaching. And also a few other things. But it ultimately found its way to the point that it formed a nationwide missionary society made up of churches and individuals as members who contribute to that, and that its mission was to carry the gospel to the world. At first, it was called the American Christian Missionary Society. And they then merged with another society or two a few years after that, and finally became known as the United Christian Missionary Society. I heard Curtis Porter preaching on this one time. And he said when you use the abbreviation, or use the acronym, rather, for United Christian Missionary Society, you have UCMS. And he said that's exactly what you see, UCMS. But what it finally it resulted in, you had a society that was overseeing the work of the brotherhood rather than the work of a local congregation. But it didn't come about overnight. It didn't happen that they went to sleep one night and they woke up the next morning they had a missionary assignment. They was overseeing the work of churches all over the country and was contributing to it, and they were spreading the gospel as a result of it. And incidentally, that United Christian Missionary Society became actually the preaching arm, for lack of a better expression, of what we know now as the Christian Church. And the Christian churches are associated with that, many of them at least, of that United Christian Missionary Society. But so they didn't get there overnight. Earl West was, and by the way, Earl West held a meeting or two here when I was just a teenager. But anyway, Earl West was a historian of that movement. Was teaching at Free Harmon College when I was there. And he wrote two volumes then, while I was there at school, called The Search for the Ancient Order, Volumes 1 and 2. And in that, he points out how it all started that led to the missionary societies. Under the heading of the chapter is Early Efforts at Organization, Cooperation Meetings. Now, they first started not with a great big nationwide thing. They started with what they call cooperation meetings. These meetings, he says, were but assemblies for the delegated messengers of the churches, who, when they came together, organized themselves with their presence, secretaries and treasurers. They made it clear that their purpose is not, now this is what they said, is not to in any way infringe upon the local autonomy of a congregation or to legislate laws for the churches, but to discuss the progress of the cause of just many ways and means of evangelizing the particular community where the member congregations were and where the member congregations who cooperated with them in the wherever they might have been, it was to get the gospel out to them. So they had these cooperation meetings where delegates from churches would come together, and they formed this cooperation with its president, and its secretary, and its treasury. And they these congregations contributed into that treasury, and others into that, and individuals into that treasury, for the noble purpose of preaching the gospel. But the problem was, they had formed an organization larger than the local church. And an entity that had its own treasury, its own oversight, and all of that, of which congregations were members of that corporation, and so on. Now, he says these corporation meetings were logical forerunners of the organizations and societies, both state and national, later to be found in the Brotherhood. Any defense that could be made for them was the same that could be made for the missionary and Bible societies. If you could defend that small institution that brought churches and individual Christians together on a level higher than the local congregation, then they could do what? They could do it worldwide. And it led to that. It finally evolved into that. And then you had the split that brought about the Christian churches and Church of Christ throughout the country. Then, thirdly, we want now to talk about the developments during this century, this last century, not today, the 2000, but up to now, the 1900s. First, there were efforts to get schools into the budget of churches. In 1938, Foy Wallace had a number of articles in the old Bible Banner where he's opposing the efforts of some of the well-known preachers of that day to try to get schools like David Lipscomb and Freed Hardeman and Harding College into the budget of churches. And declaring, of course, those folks were declaring, we also give our children a education, a good Christian education. And nobody would argue with that as far as that goes. But rather than to leave these schools as tools, as education institutions, maybe run by Christians, and maybe most of the teachers were Christians, if not all, and let them exist separately from the church, they wanted to get them into the church treasuries. And there was a big fight over that in the late 30s about getting these schools into the treasury. Well, a lot of folks could see that. And they began to ask the question, what business does the church have in secular education? In supporting schools that taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and all other such subjects. What business do churches have supporting those? And it went over kind of flat. And it didn't gain very much traction. And Wallace and others did a good job of pointing out why it should not get traction, because it wasn't the work of the church to supply secular education for children. It was a spiritual institution. Well, after World War II, of course, World War II came after the late 30s, and it came in the early 40s. After World War II, many of the soldiers had been overseas and began to see the need for the gospel, which is good in itself, the gospel overseas. And they also were concerned about poor and neglected children and orphans and so forth that they'd seen. And many of them come back and began to advocate that the churches need to get more active and more involved in foreign missions. And by foreign missions, they meant not only to preach the gospel, but also to provide for those war orphans and so forth overseas. Well, already back in this country, there some had begun to form orphan homes for children that some of them were not orphaned but neglected. But anyway, to form those, and everybody thought, well, because it's such a good work, then it ought to be all right. And it wasn't questioned a whole lot for a while. But then those who were pushing for the schools, they began to realize while the school would not go over with brethren, that maybe the orphan home would. After all, there's not a whole lot of sympathy about if you deprive a man's children of a secular education by the church. But when you begin to talk about poor little orphan children, then that became another thing. And that became a very emotional thing. And so they began to beat their drums for church support of orphan homes. The orphan home was set up with its board of directors. Now that's on this side, for the most part, on this side of the Mississippi River. The orphan homes that they set up were set up with a board of directors and with their treasurers and so forth, and churches would send their money into that organization to care for the orphans of the world in general. On the other side of the Mississippi, they set up orphan homes, such as Tifton Orphan Homes and a few others. They put them under elders of local churches. But here's the catch. These local churches solicited funds from other churches all around and to help them with their work of caring for these orphans. Well, in both these cases, what happened is folks began to realize, hey, what you've done, you have activated the church on a higher scale than local church. Whether it's under the board of directors, and you've got a bunch of churches supporting that, and they're overseeing that work, they're overseeing the work of a number of churches. The board is. Or if they send it to a central church, and that church oversees, but they oversee the funds of more than the local church, the church is said to them, they're still overseeing the work of more than the local church. And so you've, again, got an institution larger than the local church that's been activated. And so some began to ask the question, what's the difference in that institution where churches send their money and the missionary society that we rejected in the last century? Those among Churches of Christ, they rejected that. They had fought against it, and that's what caused the division between the Church of Christ and the Christian churches, for the most part. And now, they begin to wonder, how could it be right? Then, on another subject of the church's work, how could it be right for the churches, individuals, to send their money to a organization with its president and his board and his president and treasurer and all that? How can they send it there for one work of the church and it be right? And when we've all this time we said that those who did it for evangelism, they were wrong in the missionary societies and the cooperation meetings. And that touched off the controversy that we have now. Have had for this past half a century or so. And at first, during this time, most all the preachers that I knew of preached the same thing. That is, they preached on the independence of the local church. And they even preached against institutions. But when it comes to defining institutions, they were vague. And they would preach against anything other than the local church. But yet at the same time, in practice, they were activating an organization larger than local church to do the work of the church. And they pushed that and pushed it until it caused problems and often a division. But as I said, originally both preached the same thing. What happened was, some of them got their preaching and changed it and conformed it to their practice and began to defend those things. Where others who may have gone along with those things, others began to get their practice in harmony with their preaching. And they knew they couldn't preach against these other institutions and at the same time defend institutions just like them for another work of the church. And so many changed their practice to fit the preaching, to fit the principle of independence of the local church. Others began to light up on talking about the Independence Local Church because they wanted to go along with the practice. But to show that they preached basically the same thing, in 1946, Guy N. Woods, who was a big advocate of the church support of Institutional Orphan Home, edited the annual lesson commentary of the Gospel Advocate Company that we used to get, the teacher's annual lesson commentary. And on 338 of that book, we see what the preaching was. Even though he was in favor of supporting these institutions, what he preached would condemn them. Now notice, he says, the self-sufficiency of the church in organization, work, worship, and every function required of it by the Lord should be emphasized. This lesson is much needed today. Religious secular organizations are always trying to encroach on the function of the New Testament church, interfere with its obligations, and attempt to discharge some of its functions. The church is the only, and he put that in italics, the church is the only organization authorized to discharge the responsibility of the Lord's people. When brethren form organizations independently of the church to do the work of the church, however worthy their aims or right their designs, they engage in that which is sinful. I could preach that every sermon. I could preach that every day. There's no problem with that. What was the problem? The practice didn't meet the preaching. And so they later on lightened up on the preaching. Then in 1958, in the annual lesson commentary of the Gospel Advocate, this one was edited by Roy Lanier. And he talks about benevolent work on page 218. He says, Jesus, benevolence. Jesus strikes a downright blow here at ministry by proxy. Now, let me back up now. He's discussing James 1:27, where James 1:27 says, pure religion undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And we maintain that, and I think rightly so, that that's talking to individuals and not the church, but individual Christians. Well, now, this is what Lanier said, although he favored the orphan home, by the way. He says, James strikes a downright blow at the ministry by proxy, by me to give some money. Pure and undefiled religion demands personal contact with the world's sorrow, to visit the afflicted and to visit them in their affliction. The rich man, prodigal of money, which is to him of little value, but altogether incapable of devoting any personal attention to the object of his alms, often injures society by his donations. But this is rarely the case with that far nobler charity, which makes men familiar with haunts and wretchedness and follows the objects of his care through all the phases of his life. What he's saying is that this visit and the fatherless and the widows in their affliction involves and demands personal care, personal attention, personal vision, and paying attention to them. And not to put that work off of some institution, impersonal institution, and just send your money to that and feel like you fulfill your obligation to that end. So, there were orphanages that were sprang up, child havens among them, and there were churches that sprung up that were receiving funds from a number of churches they called sponsoring churches to do works like evangelism and so forth. The Hero Truth program was carried on by the church out in Abilene, Texas, the Highland Church out there. At Abilene, Texas, it was a national program that solicited funds from all over the Brotherhood, put it into a common treasury there for that work of preaching. They activated the church at a level above the local church. and there became, it was then institutionalism. And then from that, then the social gospel things began to creep in. Once you cross the line, once you have let the proverbial elephant's foot in the door, the tent gets full of elephant pretty quick. And so what they'd done, they'd let the foot in the door by doing things that they couldn't give authority for. But because of the emotional appeal they had, went ahead and practiced them anyway. It wasn't long that some began to want the church kitchens that they saw around about. That helped draw folks to the Lord. Now, the recreational programs, the social gospel aspect of it crept in. And we see the results of that now in many of these churches. And the lines began to be drawn between those who were more liberal and those who were more conservative. And it caused a great deal of turmoil. One last quotation from history is from Irvin Lee. Irvin Lee, of course, all of you know who Irvin Lee is. On page 56 and 57 of his book, Preaching in a Changing World, makes reference to this. He calls it the turmoil among Christians in the 1950s. He says, in the South, the promoters of social gospel and church-supported institutions and opponents of the innovation still met together in the early 50s. They did not like the same preachers or appreciate the same sermons. And whenever a preacher might say, that was wrong to some in the audience, so there was a situation of test of one's mental health. As the men who favored the offerings of human wisdom increased in number and boldness, they were able to fire elders and preachers and stood in their way. Almost every conservative preacher was fired at least once, and that was sometimes after having weeks or months of unhappy work. The dismissal might come suddenly after Sunday night service. And I can tell you that for a fact that was happening because I know about it firsthand. But some of the two groups were in each congregation. The preacher might move to another place where he would have a similar unhappy experience and similar abrupt dismissal. This is not what we call a job for financial security. And then he goes on to talk about the sad aspect of this firing and abuse of preachers were the experience that came to some young preachers. He talks about some young preachers with their one or two children were fired on the spot. And because they weren't well known, they couldn't find somebody else to preach and had to go back in secular work rather than to preach the gospel. Then he talks about one capable young preacher that he knew, that they gave him an ultimatum, the church did, that they had decided to support these institutions. And if he didn't go along with it, then they couldn't use him anymore. And they were going to give him some time to think about it. And he thought about it and changed his views and began to preach what they wanted to preach. All that happened during that period of time. And a lot of the younger generation doesn't realize how much some went through in order to preserve New Testament Christianity. That is, going back to the scriptures, just the individual churches, independent churches really, no organization higher than or other than the local church. But all of these things, the orphan home question, the hero truth question, and all that centered around this one principle, and that is that you've formed an organization to do the work of the church, either larger than or other than the local church, and bringing them all under an umbrella larger than the simple New Testament pattern of the only organization for the church is that of a local church doing its work on the oversight of its own personnel. And that's the reason where we are today. That's the reason now we have, in nearly every town, we have maybe two or three congregations in a town of any size that are considered to be conservative, and then there are others, and sometimes several, that are considered to be liberal to certain degrees, and they've gone way on out because they one thing led to another, led to another, until finally they completely left the New Testament pattern altogether. So the gap gets wider as the years go by, Because once people digress from the Lord's plan, they are constantly adding other innovations until the point that you hardly recognize them as the Lord's church. Satan never takes a vacation, and he'll cause history to repeat itself, if he possibly can. That is just kind of in a nutshell, or in a bird's eye view, of what is the back of and what caused the problems concerning institutionalism. And if we keep in mind this one fundamental principle, that is, the only organization that God gave the church is the local church. And nothing larger than or smaller than is to be organized to carry on that work. And when you organize something separate than or other than a local church, when I say separate than the local church, I mean when I talk about a sponsoring church, it's still separate from the local church because it is bigger in its work than the local church. But when you form anything like that, then you've taken a step in the wrong direction. Left unchecked, it may not materialize in our generation, but the next generation will take it and run with it and add more innovations until you'll hardly recognize the church at all. So that's the reason we have to keep our vigilance, to maintain the autonomy of the local church as the only organization that God has given the church to do his work. You may be here tonight, some way, somehow, accepting the Lord's invitation. If that's the case, you come while we stand, while we sing.